The future belongs to those who control the culture, and the culture belongs to those who control the conversation. So we are having the conversations you wish you could have at church to build a safe and vibrant community. This is the Oz Table Talk Podcast. Hey everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Oz Table Talk. My name is Luke. I am at the table with Dave, Stephen, Ore. Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Hey, Luke.
How you doing?
What's up?
Sup?
Why was that even funny?
I think when Ore is on the podcast, he always joins with like a really trendy g'day, which when you look at him with his really intellectual glasses on, it just seems... It doesn't fit.
There's a contrast.
Oh, it's like, sup, gangsters here. And he looks like a nerd.
I have to try to play the part, you know?
Yeah, that's it. Just for the record, all right, I like it. If he doesn't appreciate genius, like, it's his problem, right? Right.
I'm just going to let that one go to the keeper, mate.
Yep, go. You do that.
So. Next.
Or he's doing a new placement at the moment. How are you enjoying that?
Oh, it's such a learning curve, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah. Just like this past week has just been like, wow, so this is what you need to know about this. When children do this, it means that. Mm. You know, this is what you need to watch out for, you know, various parameters.
Mm. It's a pediatrics,
like,
right?
Yeah. It's so, like, children are so complex. So <Yeah. laughs> it's like one part veterinary medicine, part like full on adult medicine. You know, yeah. It's interesting. Yeah. I like it. Yeah.
Yeah,
that is so true. I love that.
I reckon you would do great in pediatrics.
Mm.
You have a way with children.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my kids love you, so that's not surprising that others would do. So what about you, Dave? You said it was a pretty full-on week for you.
Yeah, I've just got so many assignments and things going on at the moment.
Mm. Same. Swirling. I'm surprised you're here.
Yeah.
You too, right?
Yeah, part of me is not here, but I'll do my best. Yeah, no, it's just coming to the business end of term, so lots of things going on at the moment.
Yeah.
A couple of big group assignments as well, and they tend to take a bit more time and juggling because you've got to work with other people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's all right. Getting there.
Yeah, it's good.
I think I've got six on the go at the moment, but six. Only three of them are due in the next few days.
Oh, man.
That sounds anxiety-producing. I'm so glad I'm not at uni.
But they really do it to you, though. It's the same every term. It's like there's these parts of the term where there's just bunches of assignments due all at the same time.
Yeah, they're nothing in the breaks.
Right.
Yeah, spread it out. Come on.
And the thing that's frustrating is that they don't allow you to work ahead by giving you all of the content you need for the assignment or even releasing the assignment far enough in advance so you can work on it during that lull.
Hmm.
Unfortunately, they all seem to release them at the same time as well. So it's just a mad rush for 2 or 3 weeks before it's due. Yeah. It's a bit nonsensical, but anyway.
Yeah.
That's right. The joys.
Mm-hmm. It's all part of it. just think, every assignment that's done is another one you don't have to do. So,
so true.
Well, says the man who's done more study than any of us here. You know what it's like.
I mean, I relate to what you just said because like sometimes you can be overwhelmed by just a long list of things that you need to do to get to your end goal. And like just looking at it that way, like that's literally how I process it in my mind. It's like, okay, like that's one less test I have to do, you know?
Yeah.
99 to go.
It's like, it's like when you're running, you know, like you feel like I need to stop, but then you start looking at setting goals. Like I'm going to run until that light post. I'm going to run until that Mount Marvox, you know, you just keep telling yourself that whenever you arrive, you just pick something else. You know? Keep the focus where it needs to be. So
what?
So I'll come on to that. Let's talk about let's do our icebreaker. It almost feels like we don't need it, but let's talk about it because I think it's a cool question. So the Humans of Adventism question that we're grabbing this week is, what did your grandparents do for a living? I love questions like this because it sort of highlights just how far, like in the family tree, that you can come. And yeah, everyone has such different experiences. So I'm curious.
Hmm.
What about you, Dave?
There's a little bit of mystery surrounding one of my grandparents, my grandfather on my mum's side. We don't know. We don't know what he did. He was in the military, but whatever he did, he wasn't allowed to tell. So my mum thinks that it was something to do with potentially like an explosive sort of technician,
mm-hmm.
but she's not sure. That's based a lot on hearing loss and things like that. Mm. So yeah, not sure. But in the military, in one of the facets of the military.
Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, a lot of my other grandparents, I don't know what they did for a living. Mm. I think it was a little bit vague, but also... Yeah,
so anyone the only one you actually have much information about is the one who wouldn't tell you anything.
Well, it's just the most interesting.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, there's some sort of trade professions and things like that amongst the grandparents as well. But I think for some of them, it wasn't necessarily a single career path. And so, therefore, I don't necessarily remember a clear picture of what they did. But yeah. That's one. It's a bit interesting. So, you know, maybe super spy, but I'm going to go with maybe more of a... an aide in some other area of the military. But interestingly about that, my sister is now pursuing a career in the army, so as a medic.
Yeah.
So I guess you could say it's running in the family there.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's me. Mm.
What about you, all right?
Yeah, both my grandparents from both sides of the family, they've worked the land.
Yep.
Yeah, so from my dad's side, my granddad, they mostly focus on working with cocoa beans.
Yeah.
So they did granddad did a lot of that. And my mum, it was just like subsistence farming from my mum's side. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so just it's like, you know, it's a hard life.
Yeah.
Was Nigeria very industrialized in that period, or was that basically everyone was doing that sort of thing? Or are you not sure?
It's hard to... I mean, it's like comparing Monto to like a regional small town to like Brisbane, you know? It's just like, it's like similar to that, you know? You're not going to have like massive skyscrapers and, you know, like it's very much like... basic subsistence living kind of environment.
Areas.
Very regional, very not very developed kind of thing. But if you're in the cities, it's like, you know, you're in Perth. Yeah. So it's very much kind of that contrast.
Yeah.
So it's hard to answer that because it's like you go to some parts, it's like complete, like, you know, like backwater. Yeah. But then you go to some parts of Nigeria and it's like, well, that's like you're in a Western country. Yeah.
So that's now or then?
I would say both, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Still.
Probably, it's probably maybe even more of an extreme now, maybe.
Fair enough.
Yeah. What about you, Steve?
Well, grandfather on my mum's side, he did a lot of different things, like Dave said. Didn't really stick to one career. Mostly managerial kind of positions over engineering firms and things like that. Was a politician for a bit in the Pilbara in Western Australia. And then ended up being a manager at the SAN. I think he was doing RH&S stuff for the SAN. And grandfather on dad's side, he only recently retired. He was in pathology. So he ran the pathology at the SAN for I don't know how long.
Yeah.
Donkey's years.
Well, there's a link there. The SAN for both sides.
Yeah, well, that's what
So the SAN is a hospital, by the way. So
yeah, New South Wales.
In New South Wales,
That's impressive.
Yeah, that's a big
big responsibility.
Both of those big responsibilities.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It makes sense too if you sort of follow the family tree a little bit there. Your dad is in managerial hospital positions.
Yeah.
And your mum is also fairly well educated.
Well, for me, on my dad's side of the family, they're all from Malta. And over there, they're all gardeners. And so when they immigrated to Australia, they just continued farming. So they market gardeners. So they you know, grow their crops, small crops, and sell them. And that was what they did. On mum's side of the family, my nan was a weaver. So she worked at the woolen mills making towels and stuff like that. And my grandfather had two careers. His early career was as a rigger, a construction worker. He was one of the teams that built the oil refineries in Sydney. And then he had a nervous breakdown when he was, I think he was in his 40s, I think. But he couldn't go heights anymore, couldn't deal with heights anymore. So he changed and went and worked at the abattoirs, became a butcher. So and he was that until he retired. It's always interesting what people do and where they come from. But yeah, there's 101 stories that's associated to all of that. But anyway, speaking of doing lots of different things, we're talking about... like, this particular discussion could go a lot of different ways, so let's get into it. But we're talking about true education, and for that to make sense, we kind of have to flesh that out a little bit, because we're not talking specifically about conventional education.
No, right? We're not talking about schooling necessarily.
No. We're talking, so this series that we've been working on has been focused around things that we feel the church got right. And obviously we're speaking from our context of our church, because that's what we're going to know the best. But one of the things that our church has that is somewhat unique is a focus on the whole person. A lot of churches may focus on the either spiritual needs or practical needs of an individual, but our focus, or at least is supposed to be, or tries to be, one that is encompassing the whole person.
Mm-hmm.
And because that is unique, we thought it was something that was valuable to place on this list.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the pioneers of our church set up lots of organizations and ministries meeting different needs because of this perspective, you know.
Mm.
And I think true education is probably one of the reasons as well why we became such a global movement so quickly. Because it was quite easy to shift around the world, because there was an all-inclusive focus, which meant that no matter where you went, there was something that you had that was valuable to someone.
Mm.
But I think that's really interesting to sort of follow that through.
Mm.
So, for example, some of the enterprises that they got into in the early part of our movement were sort of self-supportive ministries that were around a trade or some form of skill set. A bit like you could think of the Apostle Paul, how he had a trade as a tent maker, and he used that trade to keep him going in his ministry endeavors to travel and to preach. And so early Adventism, they would set up these industries that would then support the work. And so there was this kind of all-inclusive focus where we weren't just earning money to build ourselves up. We were earning money to share with others through these gospel ministries. And then quite often the industry in itself was also a form of ministry.
Yeah.
You think of one of the ones that they did was printing, right?
Yeah.
Had these big printing presses, and they were through those printing presses were providing a place of employment for a lot of people, but then they were also through the print being able to reach out to the world. So yeah, there were lots of it's hard. I'm trying to steer away from the health side of things because we're going to do a whole episode on that.
Yeah.
But that was one of the major components where you could see this.
Mm.
But even in their schooling enterprises within early Adventism, I don't know whether you want to share about any specific ones that you're passionate about, Ore?
Yeah, I mean, I draw a lot of inspiration from, you know, the early pioneering work of the sanitariums.
Mm-hmm.
So, when you see Dr. Kellogg's work and the work that he did with his brother, they're very much like into that self-supporting model.
Mm.
So you see, for example,
can you just explain a little bit, just for people that don't understand or haven't been exposed to these ideas, what it meant to have a sanitarium and why it was so, because I mean, right now it's perhaps not as foreign an idea, but why was it such a big deal, especially when they started creating them?
I mean, it completely revolutionized the way they saw healthcare at the time.
Yeah.
So, and I don't want to, without getting into too much the health side of things, because we're going to talk about that, but essentially it's more of like a very holistic approach to health.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's about cleanliness. It's about what you eat. It's about, you know, exercise. So they really incorporated that and it was done in a way that it wasn't so, how should I say, like overly industrialized, where, you know, it didn't become so big that it lost its impact on the local population. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways they were able to do that in spite of that was to have other industries to support that main impetus of the work. For example, food factories. So they will have ways for people to come and get an education and they can work in those local industries.
John Harvey Kellogg even designed, like invented
food,
you know, to be processed in those places.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
Absolutely. And I just, it really brings to the fore how well-rounded education must have been, not just for the church, obviously, but even like I get the impression that even outside the church, from a secular perspective, education was much more well-rounded than it is today.
Yeah.
So I think the church very, very much kind of went ahead with it and grew that and made that their identity. But when you compare today and back then, it's like night and day.
And partially, I think one of the reasons why that was so easy for them to pioneer those sort of things is because they were living in a very young America. And so it was basically a pioneering country. And so they were able to establish these cultural patterns that were different than, say, the Western world in Europe may have been at that particular time. And so that the things that were new, I think, took off a little bit easier in the new America. And one of the aspects of true education I think is really pertinent to this conversation, which is actually education. Like, it is, they did start some schools. And so one of the training schools was called Madison College. And this particular school, Madison, was kind of like a bit of an experimental school where they were acting on some visions that one of the ladies in the movement, Ellen White, had had about how school should be run, along with, you know, their perspective of studying their Bibles and looking into the School of the Prophets, which we might talk about in a little bit. And they decided that the curriculum would be very balanced, holistic, as Ore was just putting. And instead of just having sit-down lessons all day, that they would actually get the students out working the land, learning practical skills, learning a trade, for example, learning how to grow their own food, prepare their own food, so that they were able to be useful in every area of life. And then even the lessons, they did a full revamp on the lesson plans. Like, they changed the lesson plans from being very theoretical to being, it's hard to describe how, but being more practical. And even they wanted this school to be a particularly biblical school. And so they even started to have their, you know, so their sort of secular lessons, if you like, the math or the whatever, they would have like Bible verses threaded throughout the math curriculum or the, you know, science curriculum or whatever. So it was very different than the way we see education
today. It's a very integrated approach.
And so that's what they were trying to do. They were trying to create a balanced individual as opposed to what we tend to create in our current society, which is specialists. Right? We train in a specific area, we become very good at that area, which is necessary and useful, but not necessarily good for you as an individual, right? Because you can become so good at what you do, but yet so useless at everything else, that you become kind of a burden on society.
No, I mean, even in my industry, I because I work alone, you know, because I'm a contract worker for most part, it means I have to have a very broad skill set even within my industry. I've spoken to people that I have helped start their own businesses, and they've got incredible qualifications, way more than I have, but they don't have the first clue about how to apply it, you know, because they only understand one very narrow section. They understand it better than anybody else is ever going to do it, but because they only understand that one narrow section of the industry, they can't extrapolate. They can't do anything bigger than that one thing that they're doing, and so they require a machine to fit into in order to operate. And I think that when we do that, I mean, that's just an example, one single example from my work, but I think we, if we try to apply that to humanity as a whole, I think that's kind of what we've done, right? You know, we have assumed specialty being the norm rather than the exception, and I think that creates more problems than it solves in a lot of ways.
And I think, like, you can see it throughout all every industry. I see it in the industry that I'm currently training for vividly. You know, as engineers, we work with tradesmen to who work out our plans, right? So we design something, but then they go and make it. And sometimes there's this divide between the engineers and the tradesmen, right? Where the tradies think the engineers don't have a clue, and the engineers think the tradies don't have a clue, and neither one of them understands the other, right? And so rather than each of us sort of walking a mile in the other person's shoes for a minute, before we start judging them, we just, you know, lash out at the other person because we can't understand where they're coming from, right? And, you know, you can apply that in all sorts of areas. Like, I remember we had a conversation recently, Luke, with a guy who works in the agriculture industry, advising farmers and things like that. And he's talking to from like a top-down sort of industry to these guys on the ground, and he's really finding it really helpful for him to sort of hear them out, to listen to their stories, because he's not a farmer. He doesn't farm. And so for him to really learn how to do his job properly, he needs to listen to the people that he's supposed to be advising so that he knows how he can give them advice, right? And so sometimes it would be better for someone in a role like that to be a farmer first, so that then you can do better at your job. And so, for example, for me, it'd be better for me to go and drive a dozer for 6 months, so that I know what to expect from the people who are the contractors contractors doing the work that, you know, when I go and design a road, for example.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so having this more holistic approach means that you can better understand the people around you, mm-hmm. what they're doing, and be more effective in what you actually do.
Right. So, I hope I'm not cutting you off here, but can we just, like, I guess, make the application? So why is this a positive way for a church to work? Why is this important?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think the reason why I think it's something that the church got right is because you see it all through Scripture.
Mm.
Like, it's in the DNA of creation. Like, if you read the creation account, God makes mankind, and the first thing he says to them is, well, the first responsibility he gives to them after telling them to be fruitful and multiply is what?
Tend the garden.
Right, but he says that you have dominion over it, right? Yeah. So he's given them responsibility over this, over creation, and he's told them, to work amongst the creation, to look after creation, tend and keep the garden, right?
Yeah.
And then when mankind stuff up in chapter 3 and God brings in the curse, he in sharing with them the curse, he says to them, for example, in verse 17 of Genesis chapter 3, it says, cursed is the ground. What does it say? For your sake. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Both thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat the herb of the field. In the sweat of your face you shall eat bread, till you return to the ground, for out of it you are taken. For dust you are, and to dust you shall return. Several times there, God is telling them the reason why the ground has been cursed is for your sake.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to work hard now for your own sake. Mm-hmm. You've got to sweat to earn your bread for your own sake, right? Yeah. And so God is here instituting like this practical process, this relationship with between us and the life that we live, whereby we should have to take responsibility for each area of our life. And I think we've sort of grown up in a culture where that's not really the case. And so I love that the church is sort of trying to take us back to that biblical perspective where we own our environment, right?
Yeah.
Where everything that goes on in our life, we understand to a certain degree and we're useful.
And also God, He gave Adam everything he needed to be happy, right? So he was catering to him from a physical perspective. Like he gave him somewhere to live in the garden. He gave him good food to eat in the garden. He catered to him relationally by creating Eve and thus catered to each other's needs for having companionship. He gave him a job to do, to tend the garden, name the animals. So he had an occupation. He knew what Adam needed in order to live that full and happy life.
Yep.
And basically, as a church, the way I see it anyway, we should be seeking to do the same thing for the people that we come into contact with.
Yep.
And ultimately, you know, making sure that they have the basic necessities of life, you know, fed, clothed, roof over their heads, all of those sort of things. But also, you know, helping people from a career perspective, making sure that they have employment that they can do and thrive in. And once all of those things are taken care of, that opens the path for ministry, right?
Yep.
Then we're capable of ministering to others. And so if we just focus on, and I've seen people do this or churches do this in the past, or individuals even within our church who don't necessarily understand this properly, but I've seen people that focus, it's all around spirituality, right? Just preach the gospel and everything else can look after itself. Nothing else is as important as the gospel. And I'm fine with that. I love the gospel and I think we should preach it. But if someone is illiterate, they can't read the gospel, right? Yep. If somebody doesn't have a house, they're not going to be going and doing ministry because they're going to be homeless. If someone doesn't have food, they're not going to be able to do anything for very long because they're going
to
be hungry. You know?
If someone's barrier to receiving the gospel is that they can't give up an addiction.
Yeah.
There's no point just forcing the gospel down their throat, is there?
No, that's right.
You need to help them
yep.
to overcome their addiction.
So I think there's a number of different aspects to this, but I was thinking before, like, how many different facets do our lives have that the church can, should, and hopefully does care about? And, you know, physically, you know, obviously we've mentioned health and we'll talk more about that in another episode. But, you know, physically there is that side of it. There's the spiritual aspect, which is we assume that any church that believes in the Word of God should be focusing on. There should be that spiritual care that is given. Occupation, so people have that productive work to do. that the mental side, and I guess this would fall into health as well, that we look after the mental health of people, because that's something that we don't do a good job of globally, and it's a lot of
people. It's so damn important.
Oh, man. Like, I know when I've been in a bad place mentally, you can't even read your Bible. You can barely even pray sometimes if you're in a bad place. And so, you know, again, how do we expect people to be interested in the spiritual if we haven't dealt with those base needs?
I once read that nine tenths of disease start in the brain.
Yeah.
And I mean, Aurea would probably be able to testify to the truth of that after having done some work in the mental health area of the hospital.
Mm.
That mental health is so critical to every other area of your life. Yeah. Sorry to cut you off, but I just wanted to emphasize that.
No, that's fine. Just a couple more things I was going to mention is relationally, because we were talking about before that Adam and Eve was given Eve and Eve Adam, in the sense that they were given that to cater to relational needs. How many people out there are lonely? You know, we've done episodes on this, this loneliness epidemic, where one of the most predictive factors for people's longevity is around their social relationships and how meaningful they are. So, you know, loneliness is life-threatening to a society. Relationally, and finally, education. Actually, you know, that process of learning, which we're chatting about before, all of these areas,
which doesn't just mean school or university.
Yeah,
education is life.
Yeah,
right.
Lifelong.
If you're not learning every day, then there's something wrong.
Yeah,
right. We're probably wasting away.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
And can I just ask if God, if you read Genesis, right, and you see God, you see Adam, Eve, a garden, an occupation or a purpose, however you want to put it, all of these things, if you take away any one of those things, what are you left with? You take away God, you've just taken away the spiritual component.
Yeah.
If you take away Adam from Eve or Eve from Adam,
you're
taking away the relational component.
Mm-hmm.
If you take away the garden,
mm-hmm.
You're taking away some of that physical
shelter,
you know, food and shelter. Yeah,
yeah, aspect of humanity. If you take away their purpose, their work, then you take away so many things, and I think one of those things is mental health.
Yeah.
Mm. So when God placed all of those things together, he was placing a whole picture for humanity in existence, right? Mm. And then what we've come and done is we've been like, yeah, well, that's all well and good, God, but I can only handle one of those strands.
Mm.
And so what we're doing is we're living a life that's not whole, right? And so Jesus comes along in John chapter 10, I think, and he says, the thief has come to steal, to kill, and to destroy, but I've come that you might have life,
and have it,
and you might have it more abundantly.
Yeah.
And we often think of that as just being a spiritual thing, right? Mm. But no, absolutely not. Jesus is talking about this holistic sense in which life should be lived.
Yeah.
And he's saying, you know, you've taken away some of the ingredients that are required for wholeness, for happiness, for you being a full person, and you're only living as a partial person, right? You're only living as partially fulfilling your potential as a human being. And so I think that's why I see this as such an important thing that the church got right, because what we're saying is that God values the whole person, and he sees so much more potential for you than you currently see of yourself.
Yeah, you know, something that just occurred to me, Dave, when you were saying that, I think possibly one of the core issues that's behind this, again, is that... Okay, so everybody probably just heard that, and I could edit this out later, but I'm not going to, because I'm going to tell you that my 18-month-old has had a lovely time setting alarms for me, and so my phone's been doing that at random times for the last 3 hours, and I'm really hoping they stop before I go to bed.
Why don't you open up alarms and just
turn them off?
I thought it was only a once off, but apparently it's not.
Well, there's different tunes.
Permission to go in and do it now if you want to.
Yeah, that's okay. We'll survive. Okay, so what I was going back to saying is one of these foundational things is the difference between, you know, Greek thought and Hebrew thought.
Yeah, I was thinking that.
Yeah, and if we have this Greek idea where there is this separation between the spiritual and the physical and
the intellectual and the practical.
Exactly. If we do that, then we end up at a whole bunch of conclusions that God never intended. He never. There's nowhere in Scripture that talks about the physical being evil. It's and the spiritual is really the only thing that's important. This dualism actually doesn't serve the gospel at all.
Yeah.
And I think that that's one of the things, obviously not the only thing, but that's one of the things that we see as a part of the degeneration that we see during the Dark Ages. Because that if the physical doesn't matter, well, then it doesn't matter if we look after the people. It doesn't matter any of that, as long as you get your last rites before you die, and as long as you pay the church enough money for your indulgences, then, you know, spiritually you're okay. You've got eternity ahead of you, so who cares about your health? Who cares about your, you know, relational life? You know, let's call the priest celibate and get on with the job. You know, all of these aspects, they take away those pillars of the experience from Eden. And they wonder why everything, you know, went to dirt pretty much through the Dark Age period. So really speaking, what we're saying that our church has done, obviously we're not the only people that have cried out for a holistic view of creation and how we serve others, but ultimately this is reversing a lot of the damage that was done over the previous thousand years.
You put that by saying we're returning to Hebrew thought.
Yeah.
That's a good way to look at it. Mm. So if we just fast forward a little bit in the Bible, another sort of picture of this holistic kind of lifestyle and education, or education of life, let's put it, rather than just education, otherwise it gets a little bit blurry, is Moses. Because Moses grew up in Egypt. Mm. And if you want to talk about education from the Greek perspective, Moses had it all, right?
Yeah.
Moses would have been trained
anywhere.
Militarily, academically. I mean, he was being set up to be the next pharaoh.
Yeah.
So he would have had the best of everything. And yet when God called him to do a work, God saw that as insufficient for the work that he was going to be doing, right?
Might have even been a barrier.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that's a fair point.
Yeah.
And so rather than God saying, all right, let's sit in a classroom and I'll teach you exactly what you need to know to be a good leader to the Israelites, which God could have done, and God, you would think, would have been the very best teacher possible. And yet, God suggested the best way for him to learn was to go and manage sheep for 40 years.
Because that does my head in.
Because when you think about it, that was the perfect education for managing a bunch of sheep.
I was going to say, what are you talking about, Dave? Sheep are stupid. They get into trouble all the time.
Stubborn
Stubborn. Yeah, I know. Why would that be a good training for dealing with people?
Yeah, well, just go and read Numbers, mate.
Whereas, today there was, you know, most, if you wrote that in your autobiography, most people would see that as a waste of time. Like, wow, you wasted that period of your life.
And 40 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I mean, he's got long service leave from his sheep tending. Yeah.
A few times over.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is another area where God is revealing to us the importance of seeing the whole person. Mm. You know, Moses had been developed in certain areas, but God saw his development in other areas as unfinished. Mm. And so God needed that to be finished off so that he could be a better leader for Israel, for the job that he had.
Yeah. And that made me think, I don't know if you guys know Robbie Morgan, some of the listeners might. He's currently a pastor down Coast Life Church in New South Wales, but he wrote a pretty cool song. I think it's called Unlearned, but it's about Isaiah chapter 2 verse 4 about how the people of Israel would beat their swords into plowshares and they won't learn war anymore.
Yeah.
So like it was about teaching Moses how to deal with stubborn people because people are stupid.
Yep.
But it was also unlearning him a lot of the things that he had learnt in his time in Egypt.
Yeah.
Like unlearning his anger, different things like that.
Yeah, and
that's
like
that's a really good
to thought. Make like relevant application of this. You can be like a corporate manager, you know, managing hundreds of people, and yet if you can't manage your own home, then you're not whole, right? I feel like that's a little bit bold to say because maybe one of our listeners is wrestling with that. Like, how can they be whole given their massive responsibility? And maybe it might require a time of unlearning or a time of retreat from what you're doing to get yourself in order. Or maybe it's just working on little things, you know, just little things and building from there. Like, you know, all right, the first thing I need to know to manage my home is how to, you know, cook or clean or whatever, pick up some simple skill and just work on that and then build it on that and build on that and build on that. Mm. But, you know, we've got to be able to be useful in every sphere of our life, so that we're not letting down one of those areas that you're talking about, Luke. Because if you can't manage your home successfully or share that load if you've got a family, then you're going to have relational breakdown, which is going to cause mental breakdown, right? And then all of a sudden, your occupation might be the best thing in the world, but you're not whole. You're not whole.
I wanted to play devil's advocate a little bit and just highlight the fact that like we live in a society that is very different to where our grandparents lived and where I would even argue that Moses lived. So barring the fact that we have so much information at our fingertips and things have become so complex that to have a basic understanding of a computer, you need to like have a maybe even a bachelor's degree in some kind of computer science. How can we remain relevant in this complex world? How can we even survive in a competitive economy in this world and still have that balanced education? I mean, some would argue that it's very difficult to do that now. Like you have to be relevant, you have to specialize. To be useful, you have to focus on one thing. You can't afford to diversify because you're just going to be left behind.
Yeah, there is a brilliant book called Range, and the name of the author escapes me right now. But it talks about this very question, and it's a secular book. It's not even a spiritual book, but this very question of how do you balance the idea of, you know, being a jack of all trades or a polymath versus being a high-end specialist, and what's most valuable, and which should you choose? And there's actually been a lot of data assembled around this, and the most successful people, like it is tiered to a degree, and obviously there are outliers in each way, but typically the most successful people based on the studies that they did are people that had what they called T-shaped expertise. So they had proficiency, not expert level, but proficiency in a very broad set of skills and expertise in one specific skill. And the breadth of proficiencies accelerated or exponentially grew the value of the depth of the one specialty they had. When I listened to it as an audiobook, and when I heard that, I thought that makes so much sense because, you know, because you're able to do that, then you're able to bridge ideas between all of the things you have proficiency in with where you have your deep level of expertise. And I think that's arguably, that's, even though we haven't said that specifically, I think that's kind of what we see in scripture as well. You know, like Moses, for example, you know, going back to him as an example, he would have had a very broad skill set, and his leadership skills were probably very well developed early in his life because of his experiences in Egypt, for sure. But he didn't have the patience. He didn't have all of the other things that he needed in order to be a good leader. And so, therefore, go tend sheep, right? So he needed to broaden his experience so the depth actually meant something. And so I think that's probably a good way for us to think about it.
I know it's not like quite relevant, but I find that having a broad set of experiences makes you a lot more relevant to a lot more people. Like I found in conversations, like I'm just thinking of a few things now, like I can weld, but not very well at all. But it means that I can have a somewhat sensible conversation with like a Boilermaker. And like, you know, I've done lots of different things, and it's just having that like common connection as well that makes human interaction a lot more simple.
And maybe not from a career development perspective, which is, I think, where you were going with your devil's advocate comment. But that is very useful in an evangelistic, from an evangelistic perspective. It's much easier to have relatable conversations with random people that you don't necessarily know when you've got a breadth of understanding that you're talking about. So that's really important. And I really like what you just said, Luke. That was really... that was really insightful and quite relevant to the conversation and to what you were saying, Ori. But I was also thinking, like, if you think about Moses, another thing that was really important with Moses was that he continued to learn. So he spent 40 years tending sheep, and that was like his mass training, if you like. But then not far into his journey into the desert, Jethro was telling him, "You don't know what you're doing, mate. You know, you're a terrible leader. You need to delegate." And he took that on the chin and he started to delegate, right? And so, yeah, I think that's another really important aspect to, I suppose, maybe address what you're talking about, Ori, because becoming a specialist in any field takes an awful lot of time and dedication. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so you can't necessarily be very good at everything else while you're spending the time and dedication. Mm. But you need to have an out of some description in your life just to be sane and healthy, right? Mm. And so if you use that out to continue to develop other areas of your life, whether it be through hobbies or through some form of practical training in whatever it happens to be, learning to cook, as I mentioned before, or learning to, I don't know, work on your car or whatever it happens to be that's going to be useful to you. Mm. You can do that incrementally and, like Moses, be learning along the way skills that make you give you more breadth in your life whilst you're still pursuing your specialty of like your area of excellence, if that makes sense. Because I don't think the two are mutually exclusive, but I think there needs to be, I guess, some intentionality about developing balance in your life, if that makes sense. Does that kind of answer where you were coming from?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm starting to learn to see it even in the medical profession, because I've noticed that to be successful in some of these high-end specialties, a lot of the doctors, they will ask you, actually, during an interview, they will say, what are your hobbies? What do you do outside of medicine? And if you say that, no, I just dedicate my life to medicine, thinking that you're going to impress them, they'll actually look frowningly upon that.
Okay. So
they'll see you as a very unbalanced person and probably incapable of caring for patients.
Yeah.
And I found that quite fascinating. Like, you know, it almost sounds counterintuitive. Mm. Like, thinking that, oh, if I just said, oh, like, medicine's my life, you know, that's like, I eat, breathe, and drink medicine.
Yeah.
But they'll actually look at you and be like, this guy's a weirdo. Like, he's not going to be able to relate to patients at all.
Yeah.
Or they may look at you and go, you know, I'll give you a few years and you'll burn out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No self-care.
Yeah. So
yeah, you wouldn't have had that trouble if when they ask you that question because you've got all these different areas of interest in your life. So.
Yeah. And so, you know, just fast forwarding a little bit further through the Bible so we can sort of continue to move on with this episode. Mm. You've got so many people. I think we were just sort of brainstorming earlier and we had Joseph.
Yep.
We had David. Yep. We had Daniel. And then you have all of the prophets virtually along the way because they set up this thing called the School of the Prophets, right?
Yeah.
And you think Elijah and Elisha and these kinds who were sort of the ones that were sort of the big name prophets who helped to set up these schools of the prophets. They had like a breadth in their experience. They weren't just, you know, God's messengers and that's all that they were good at, all that they did. And so they decided to set up this system of education whereby anyone who was training to be useful in the priesthood or in as a prophet or a servant in Israel, they'd have to learn a trade. You know, they'd have to learn useful life skills that would give them that balance that we've been talking about. And I think that would make them relatable, like you said, Steve. I think that's a really, really important aspect.
And it's very hard to support or minister to somebody when you have no understanding of what they're going through.
Yeah.
You know, and if you have never, as an example, like if you have lived your entire life in academia, you know, so some people, they go to school, they come out of school, they go to university, they come out of university and they go teach at university and they live their entire life in that bubble.
Yeah.
You know, if that kind of person was trying to minister to someone who, you know, was having, you know, like stress in their job as a carpenter or whatever it was, that would be so difficult for them to even see the challenges that person was going through. Yeah. And so I think having, even if you can't go and do every single thing to have every single experience, I think if we classify those broad categories and at least get a degree of experience in all of them, it gives us a much greater platform from which to minister.
Yeah. And yeah, like you just pointed out, it's not a case of, you know, I need to go and get every single job that's out there so that I can relate to everybody. It's a case of being aware of those, how many did you come up with? Six categories? Could be more, could be less. Of areas of your life that are the things that make you a whole person.
Yeah.
Being aware of them and being intentional to take care of all of those aspects and to share yourself in all of those aspects.
And it feels like a lot when you say it like that, right? Those six categories or whatever, you sort of feel like, oh, you know, you got to stay on top of all those things. But really speaking, it's a case of building good habits. It just boils down to setting good habits in our lives. And a lot of people need help to do that, right? To either pull down the barriers that stop them from doing it or to just educate them on how to get started. And I think that if we do think about it less as a checklist that we need to get through and more of just a fulfilling life, you know, because a fulfilling lifestyle, it must have, you know, some sort of purpose in it. It must have, you know, some kind of outlet for, you know, mental health. It must have some kind of relationships in it in order for it to be fulfilling. So it's really just, we're just describing a life that is that full, abundant life that we were talking about before.
I would say that God wants us to be well balanced and to be able to be not just useful with our minds, but with our hands, that we may perhaps maybe develop calluses in our hands so that we don't have to be callous towards the needs of others. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Put that on a bumper sticker.
I like that. I like that a lot.
Yeah, well, you know, all right, you just mentioned that, and it just sort of struck me. Jesus, right? Obviously, always going to be the best example for any of this. And Jesus was obviously the highest level spiritual teacher that anybody has ever seen. And yet he spent, you know, the first 30 years of his life getting those calluses and doing good for the people that were around him. And I often think, I personally would love to know why we don't know more about his early life. Like, I so wish that the Bible dealt with more of Jesus' experience when he was just living his life as a carpenter in Nazareth.
Mary didn't write a book.
Hey? Yeah, Mary didn't write a book. Yeah, that's right. But I wish he had, because I really feel like I would be able to relate to that Jesus, right? Because, I mean, even though there is stuff to relate to in his official ministry, I think a lot of us are in the season that he spent the first 30 years in, not the season that he spent the last 3 years in. Mm-hmm. So, I just think that would be fascinating, because that's where we get those calluses. That's where he developed that breadth of understanding. And Peter Roenfeldt was doing a presentation on what Bethlehem would have been like, Nazareth, excuse me, would have been like during Jesus' growing years. And we often think of it as this backwater village where he would have just lived and worked and that was that. But what he was pointing out was that it was actually very, very close to the main highway that went between nations. So he would have been able to have like a 5-minute walk and watch people from every nationality passing. Wow. And interact with people, because back then obviously they weren't going past in cars, you know, they were walking, and so you actually interacted with people as you traveled, and you know, he would have had to go along that road probably every day going to work, because the township itself would have only been, I think he said, 30 houses or something like that, so not enough to employ a full-time carpenter. So he would have had to have gone to the nearby cities to build things, or for, you know, whatever projects were taking place. And so he would have been like interacting with hundreds of people on a weekly basis, going about being Jesus, right? You know, serving others and all the rest. And I'm like, man, I wish I knew more about that, because we don't think about that part of his life. And he was developing, he was the perfect example, you could say, of developing that well-rounded, true education sort of character that we're talking about.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So bringing this to a practical application as we close. So what did the church get right? Well, we decided that this was important, and so we started training schools, we started sanitariums, we started self-supporting ministries. And more recently, there are many ministries in the church that are not focused on spiritual needs, but just physical needs. You've got things like ADRA, the Adventist Development and Relief Agency, that go in after disasters and help with cleanup and that sort of thing. You've got ministries, I'm just going through Australian ones because I know them best, but Asian Aid, for example, that sponsor children, you know, bring them up through education and things that can't afford it in Asia.
Yeah.
You've got all of these sort of humanitarian type ministries, and studying engineering at the moment, one of the things we talk about frequently in engineering today is human-centered design. And human-centered approach is becoming more and more, I guess, central in not just engineering, but just in the professional industries as a whole. And that basically just means that we listen to the needs of people and we respond to their needs, not to our wants.
Yeah.
You know, and so from a design perspective, we design for what people want and need. We, you know, in a health profession, we treat patients according to what they need. Like you were saying before, we actually care for them. We don't just treat them as you know, data. For example, in politics, we make decisions and policies from a human-centered perspective, where we listen to society. We spend some time with, say, for example, homeless people to find out what it means to be homeless and how that we can help the homeless people. We don't just make decisions from our, you know, big tables in our big rooms from our throne, so to speak. We get down, we get dirty, we understand people, and we make holistic decisions based upon their needs. Yeah. And that's what true education means. That's what our church sort of took on from an early stage, and we've tried to hold on to that. And yeah, look, we waver at some stages and we get a bit specialized in the church, you know, where we start to focus entirely on one thing or entirely on another. But we always sort of come back to the Bible and we realize, nah, Jesus was interested in the whole person.
Yeah.
Jesus was interested in his whole person, as you brought up. Mm. But he went around healing. He went around helping. He went around teaching. He went around preaching. Mm. And so, yeah, we too should be focusing on the whole gamut of human need, not just you need Jesus.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a good place for us to bring this one to a close. We have one more left in this series, and I hope you stick around with us for that one. It's possibly going to be one of the most important ones yet. So we will catch you guys next week. If you've enjoyed this, please share it with a friend, and thank you so much for writing this out with us. We will catch you in the next episode. And that's the end of another episode. Just before I head off, I want to encourage you to go over to our page on Facebook and also our account on Instagram and follow us there, because that is where we interact with our listeners, and we would love for you to enter in and join the conversation. Also, while you're signing up, I would also recommend signing up to our mailing list on our website, oztabletalk.com.au. If you do that, you will receive our exclusive content, because occasionally we do release exclusives and they only go out to our mailing list. So I would strongly recommend you go and sign up for that. If you have a few more minutes to be one of the most amazing listeners on the planet, you can go over to iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a review, because reviews help us to grow and they help other people to find us. So if you want to help us reach those goals, please jump in and give us a review. The final message that I'd like to leave you with is to let you know about our Patreon account. Now, Patreon is a way for creators to get paid for creating, and ultimately what we do does cost money to get us hosted and have the services that we need to run the podcast. And so if you'd like to help us do that, jump over onto patreon.com/oztabletalk, and you can give anything from even a dollar a month upwards. But at different levels, there are different benefits, different rewards that we want to give you, just to say thank you for being an amazing supporter of ours. If you can't afford that, we would just gratefully accept your prayers, because that is what our ministry runs on. And so with that, I will leave you to your day, and thank you so much for listening to this episode. We look forward to seeing you guys next week.